This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
You are listening to The Mauer Report, a live radio show that ventures into the mysteries of life, as well as the hot topics of the day, either political or business. I want to welcome everybody. I feel good tonight. I'm not sure what's going on, so we're going to keep that going. I hope. My guest tonight is Zachary Elwood. Zach, how are you doing tonight?
I'm good. How are you, Jim?
Pretty good. I didn't even ask you, is it Zach or Zachary? Because I see it on Skype as Zach, and then I see it on Twitter as Zachary, so I guess I should clear that.
Zach's good. I'm loose. Either one's good, but Zach's good.
So I've got the easy question is, you do a number of things. You've wrote some books. You host a podcast. You do this, you do that, which is amazing. I'm always confused by people that write and can do the audio stuff. Which one do you prefer?
Definitely the writing. I mean, that was always my main, one of my main passions and backgrounds. And honestly, like the interview, the podcast definitely came later. I mean, I never wanted to be any sort of performer or talent or anything like that. And it always made me very nervous. So I would say definitely the writing and the podcast just kind of learned the ropes as I went and got more comfortable with it, but definitely more comfortable with the written word, yeah.
That's okay. We'll get you through tonight, though. Books about poker. What? I'm guessing you had an interest in poker first.
Yeah. So I used to play poker for a living. Solely for a living for 3.5 years as my main source of income, and then supplementally on the side since then. Before and after a little bit. That was how I got into it, and that was back, when I was playing a lot for a living. That was back in, 2004 to 2006 time period. So that's what led into writing the books. It was basically, I played a lot of poker, and the materials that I knew of for poker tells, for poker behavior, were not very good, and I knew things that I had never seen written about, and, talking to other poker players, knew that there was knowledge that book, and there were some books out there, but one of them was the most well-known one was, had been written quite a long time ago and felt pretty outdated. And then there was some other stuff I thought was pretty subpar. So that's what led into me writing the poker behavior books, which I wrote, started in 2011, started working on that stuff. So it was significantly after I was playing for a living, but it was more about the fact that I hadn't seen good content come out that, I was surprised that it took that no one had put out better books for that long, basically.
So let's back up for a second, because I find this fascinating that you played poker full time for a living for a number of years. Had to have been, I don't want to say the most nerve wracking thing that you've ever done in your life, because I don't know you that well yet, but it's got to be close.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's cumulative. On the cumulative level, it's stressful. I wouldn't say it's stressful at any certain point. I mean, there can be those too, but really, it sounds more impressive than it is. I think a lot of people are like, wow, how is that possible? But when we get down to it, it's if you just, at a basic level, it's about understanding that, if you just think about people, there's a lot of people that can fool themselves into thinking they're good at something when they're not. And poker, professional poker players are just taking advantage of that, because there's, by and large, most of the money comes from people who are very bad at poker, in the same way that people are very bad at many things, and they're good at it. And the interesting thing about poker, what makes it so profitable, is that the complexity of it is hidden. It takes a long time to understand just how complex a game poker is, and so you can fool yourself into thinking you're good at it in ways that it's harder to do that for other things that are obviously complex, right? Because you can play poker for a short period of time and think you're quite good at it. So the complexity is hidden. And, you know, all it means to be a professional poker player is you're taking it seriously and being objective about it when a lot of other people that you're playing with just are not at that, taking it that seriously. So it sounds more impressive than it is, I think. And or you know, not to some people. Some people are just like, oh, you're a degenerate gambler. But for the people that think it's impressive, I think there's basically just like, yeah, you're basically just, you know, for the most part, taking advantage of the fact that many people just don't know what they're doing.
So now I'm going to lead the witness a little bit. I'm guessing this epiphany that poker is a little bit more complex and you're just beating the odds, so to speak, and your decision to start playing part-time came about the same time.
Well, no, it's complicated because, you know, I never really wanted to be it was never my goal to be a professional poker player. It was something I just kind of fell into. Actually, like bringing it back to your point about it being stressful, it is a stressful way to make a living. Like the more high up in stakes you go, the more, you know, stress can be applied. And that's especially true. Even if you're a winning player, the cumulative effects of stress are real. Like, you know, for example, even though, you know, I was doing pretty well, the losses are still stressful. And, it, you know, in a similar way, you know, it's hard to get over the fact that those things are stressful, even if you're a winning poker player. So you kind of get used to the winning, and that you're kind of neutral about the winning, but the losses, the downswings, which you're always going to have upswings and downswings in poker. Like even if you're the best player in the world, you have significant, you know, you can have significant losing periods. So the downswings continue to be a negative, stressful factor, and you just kind of get used to the upswing. So it's definitely a stressful way to make a living, but they, you know, speaking to the complexity side, I mean, there's people that poker is such a complex game. Like there's no end of study you can put into it, whether that's the strategy. I mean, because the branching of the game tree is more complex than chess. Like it's harder for, you know, computers to solve game theory optimal solutions of no limit hold'em than it is to solve chess, basically. It's a very complex game when you factor in you can bet anything at any time and you can have multiple players, et cetera, et cetera. There's all these, you know, wild, complex game trees. But, yeah, so there's no end you can of the work you can put into it. But I think, yeah, for most people, it just ends up being pretty stressful. Yeah, and that was definitely true for me. It was never my goal to, you know, go to Vegas and play high stakes, because I kind of knew my limits. Like I knew that I'm kind of an anxious person, basically. Yeah.
So let's get into the reading of the tells and when that became an interest of yours. How did that all develop? Because I'm sure, I mean, sitting around the table, you started noticing things about people, but when did you realize that you were onto something?
Well, it was basically a combination of me, you know, taking poker seriously for a few years, playing for a living for a few years, and realizing that, thinking that the books that were out there, the resources that were out there just weren't very good. And, you know, and I was playing back in the early days of the poker boom, so to speak. They call it, you know, and basically after 2003, when poker went on a huge upswing and there were many, you know, pretty decent stake games that were very easy because you know, people were playing online, and Chris Moneymaker won the World Series, and he was an amateur. He won the World Series of Poker main event. And so there was a big influx of players. And yeah, so I was kind of surprised that I always assumed that there'd be somebody, you know, more prestigious than me, more well-known than me in the poker world that would put out a strong book of poker behavior. And I always assumed it'd be like a Phil Ivey or, you know, Daniel Negreanu would come out with some book. But I think, you know, after a few years, I was very surprised that didn't happen. And I think basically it was like the people that really like playing poker, which I don't include myself in that because, like I said, I'm kind of an anxious person. So I think most people that are good at poker and enjoy it just didn't have the patience to write a book about it. They were just interested in doing it and playing high stakes and stuff. Whereas, like, I didn't have that motivation. So I think that's what led to the fact that there wasn't during the poker boom, there really wasn't a good book of poker tells that came out. And I think, you know, you could ask around, many people would say mine, you know, are, you know, besides Mike Caro's book, which is from, like, 1980, mine are the best book out there. Like, they're the most well-known and most respected. So I think that kind of helps explain why there was that huge gap in, like, respected poker tells books.
Now, don't take this the wrong way, because, well, you're not going to, but somebody out there listening may. Okay, so I guess that's why I'm preferencing that by saying it this way. But the bet, like, I'm thinking about all the pro athletes, right? Like your Michael Jordans and your Wayne Gretzky's and, you know, these high level stars. Maybe John Elway, but maybe not. I'm still on the fence about him. The great high level stars don't necessarily make the greatest executives and player development people or coaches even. It's always the mid-level or below, the guy that had to fight for every inch that he got. And I'm kind of hearing that with your journey with putting a book together, because while those great people are out, you know, they're just interested in playing. I don't think they necessarily care about the tactics, because they believe being whoever is enough to beat you. It doesn't matter if you tell them or not.
Yeah, no, there's definitely something to that. I mean, things align for me to be the person that did that, because honestly, I think if I enjoyed poker just a little bit more, I would have been playing it more and not, you know, focused on writing about it, you know, honestly. And there is that thing, I think, too, of, you know, my background and or my interest in writing and being a clearer communicator was a factor in my book's success, because, you know, even though I readily admit that there's people that strong, you know, very good poker players that are much better at reading people than I am, but they probably couldn't communicate the theory behind, you know, why they are doing the things they do, you know. And a lot of it might be instinctual, and I've talked to very strong poker players who talk about the instinctual aspect of it, but then a lot of it, I think, is just not being writers, not being communicators. They have a hard time putting those concepts in words, whereas, like, that was a combination of my interest was poker, and I've always been interested in being a very clear communicator, and I find that interesting too. So I think it was a combination of those things.
So now I've got this very half-cocked question, because I know this to be true, because back in the day when I, you know, gathered the boys up and play, there was always one, didn't matter necessarily who we had, but there was always one in the crowd of six or seven who would grab the sunglasses because he didn't want you to know what he was thinking. Is that the most worthless thing in the history of man, wearing sunglasses while you're playing poker?
I think it's of dubious quality to prevent people from getting reads, because honestly, you know, most of the reads I would use and most of the reads I'm talking about are not related to the eyes. I mean, there are some eye tells, but so I mean, it does have a value. I think it's a complex subject, because I think I've never worn, except for a few times when I was playing tournaments, I've never worn sunglasses. The reason a lot of sunglasses is because it creates like an unfriendly atmosphere, and most professional poker players are trying to foster a real friendly, like, loose atmosphere. So if you put on glasses, you know, you basically make everybody else less friendly, less loose. And so that's one angle of it. But I think one of the main values of wearing sunglasses, which I think, you know, a lot of people don't know, is it's mainly about letting you study other people without them knowing. And so they don't know where you're looking too, and that, I think that's a big value too, is just being able to study somebody. They don't know you're looking towards them and things like that. But yeah, there's definitely things that sunglasses cover up. I mean, I do talk a good amount about, you know, eye direction tells, and basically eye looseness tells when you're, like, when you make a big bet on the river. For some people that they are just so loose in their mannerisms, and that includes their eyes. So they'll, like, even if their body is still, that they're trying to control their body, their eyes might be moving around kind of dynamically, like, you know, glancing from one place to another. And for most people, that's a sign that they're pretty relaxed, you know? So those kind of things can give some information. But yeah, it's an interesting area.
Well, that's what I'm asking. Cause I mean, I always found that amusing, because I do see the benefits that you're saying, but I knew, you know, they weren't studying anything besides just trying to be that.
Right. Yeah. A lot of people just want to do it because it seems cool. Like, they don't actually know why they're doing it or what they're protecting against. And again, I'd say, you know, most in cash games, and especially not so much in tournaments, but in cash games, most professional poker players aren't wearing sunglasses because it just brings a lot of seriousness that nobody really wants. Like, most people are trying to make the game less serious, you know. But tournaments are a different story. So yeah, tournaments and cash games have very different dynamics. Like, tournaments, people are usually very buttoned down and serious and wearing the sunglasses and the hoodies and stuff, whereas cash games can have looser atmosphere, and because they don't have an end, you know. And There's no like build up in blinds and stuff. But,
yeah. So the next question is, you mentioned the poker boom, what, 2003-ish to now, so almost 20 years. How has the game kind of evolved through that time period?
Well, that's a big area. I mean, there's differing thoughts on that, but as a in a nutshell, basically, you know, between 2003 and, you know, 2008 or so, it was like, you know, very easy games online and live. And then, you know, people started getting better. The quality of the general person's play went up a lot. You know, there was a lot of learning resources online. So online became tougher and tougher. I mean, live is still much easier than online, because people who play online, you quickly get destroyed online because you play so many hands if you don't have a strong strategy. So it pre-selects for, you know, you're going to get crushed online if you don't have a strong strategy. So online is very tough these days. Live is less so, but still tougher. You know, there's more people playing, though. It's a tough thing to talk about, because you have more people playing on one hand than you did pre-2003. But the general quality of play for, you know, for higher stakes especially is larger than it was pre the 2003. So there's a number of factors, but basically the games have gotten tougher for the most part.
Well, just the number of players has to make the game tougher because of just pure luck.
Well, no, not necessarily. The number of players wouldn't impact that, because, you know, if the number of players increase and they were all pretty bad, that would be great for your average professional poker player. But what tends to happen, especially online, is, you know, there's so many resources out there for learning and studying, and people join study groups of poker. And for anybody who wants to take it seriously, there's so many more tools now than, you know, including my stuff. There's so many more tools out there for anybody who wants to take it remotely seriously than there was pre-2003. So,
last poker question. You're still telling me to fold that 2-7, right?
You know, that's the word on the street. You know, it's, you know, I'm not saying you can. I don't want to discourage people from mixing it up. But yeah, you probably should fold it.
You got to play it once just to show somebody you're crazy enough to do it.
Yeah, exactly. That's like the old Mike Caro, the mad genius. You know, he'd show his thing was all about, like, show him how crazy you are, and you know, that can still have value in the right game for sure.
And hey, if that flop comes 2-7-7, I mean, it's mad crazy.
Don't ever see it coming.
Yeah. So as we transition back in the more mainstream kind of events, what got you going more mainstream? Because I know you've done a lot of work in and around this.
Well, you know, I just do things I'm interested in on the side. I have a day job these days too, doing some software documentation, technical writing. But on the side, I do things I'm interested in, which is, you know, my podcast and also my some investigations into, you know, independent personal stuff I do for investigating, researching online deception, which I've written some pieces about, and that some of that got featured in some Washington Post and New York Times and other places, basically just examining some cases of like fake social media accounts and where some misinformation was coming from, that kind of thing. And I think it kind of falls in the same category of being interested in, you know, finding clues of deception and things like that. I think that's what ties all the stuff together, I guess, if I had to say.
Yeah, I was reading some of that stuff you sent me this afternoon about online deception and about that fake video that I was reading about that I didn't really grip completely because my mind was kind of numb to it. give me the backstory of that, because I missed something in there and it just didn't make sense.
Oh, well, that video, basically, you know, Perez Hilton, which is like a celebrity gossip person. I don't really know who he is myself, but he gossips about celebrities, I guess. So anyway, he posted some video which, you know, seemed to show a white woman being in a neighborhood being racist, offensive in a racist way to a a black jogger, a young black jogger. It showed an interaction between them. And so a lot of people just accepted it at face value and got angry about it. But immediately to me, I thought it was, you know, and not just me, other people did too. Some people did. It struck me as very staged and fake. So I was like, I even, you know, took the chance of going online saying, this seems very fake, which, you know, is always a risk in these, heightened, sensitive times. I could have, if I had been wrong, it would have been bad for me to say that video was fake, basically. But I felt so confident that was fake. I was like, oh, this seems fake, and for multiple reasons, and I'm sure it'll come out that it was fake. And eventually it did. And then I wrote a blog post or a post on Medium about, you know, the reasons why, the many reasons why it pointed at being staged, you know, fake. And I'm interested in that stuff. I actually have a video film degree, and I briefly did some forensic video analysis, you know, as a job. But mainly, I think it's my background, and, you know, thinking about how actors act when you're directing actors for video, that kind of stuff, that makes me attuned to those kinds of things that I think some people, you know, there's a good number of people attuned to those things too. But I think that's my interest in it is trying to tease out the specific reasons why this seems fake or this seems staged, those kinds of things.
Which is interesting because when the show started years, oh God, too many years ago, it was a paranormal show. So fake videos and pictures have kind of always been something that I've kind of kept an eye on. So here we are crossing paths from two different points. So how much stuff do you see that you think, I mean, obviously you called the one out, but how much stuff out there makes you really wonder about?
Oh, well, I see a good amount, and I wanted to add to that. That post I put up was meant to be like a starting point of like other things I want to look at, so I was going to put them all on one post. But yeah, I mean, there's plenty of videos I see where I'm just like, you know, either it seems like it's staged, or, you know, and that could just be for entertainment. Like in this case, the thing I examined was just people messing around, like they were just, I don't know what they were really trying to do, they're just being silly. But, you know, in other cases, there can be more nefarious reasons, or there can be, you know, weird editings or out of context things. I mean, there's a range of things that I think, you know, what interests me is how people on social media react in bad ways to these things, you know, whether it's an out of context, you know, clip, or whether it's a edited clip or whatever it is. I think people tend to be overly certain about their abilities to deduce what's going on, you know, because usually there's so many even for actual real video, there's so much context there, you know. I think it's that's what interests me is how people reach these over certain and often, you know, angry responses to things, where to me, I look at many videos online, I'm like, well, I need more information about what's going on there before I reach a conclusion. But I think it's kind of a symptom of our the way I think social media is kind of deranging us as a whole population is these instincts to jump to conclusions about things that we really should, you know, if we were being more reflective or more intelligent about it, we would say, okay, we need to find out what is actually going on with this piece of news or this video. But the instinct or the drive a lot of people have is just to reach an immediate conclusion, because everybody loves certainty, I think is what it boils down to. We want to be certain. We want to reach a conclusion. We want to know what's going on. We want to have an opinion, and we're rewarded for having an opinion, you know? So there's all these things that line up to give us a kind of a perverse incentive to be certain or to have an outraged opinion about something immediately.
Yeah, the outrage machine always is a factor. I mean, it just, mm-hmm. I never see anybody being overly positive instantly. Like, good stories take forever to get going, but outrage,
you're right about
fake
that.
Outrage, instant. It's just
For sure. And there's even studies about you know, how angry messages, negative messages, spread quicker on social media, and I think that, you know, it's understandable because like we're wired to, you know, as humans, to respond to threats, you know, and so when we see the negative things, it triggers something in us, and we get agitated about it, and we spread it to other people, and they get agitated about it, and reaches kind of new, you know, critical mass or whatever.
And I've got a prime example of this that happened today. Tiger Woods was involved in a car accident, and the headline that I seen that they had to use the jaws of life on to get him out of the car. And then a couple hours ago, I watched the press conference, and the firefighter's like, no, they used an axe and a pry bar and pried him out, and, you know, and it's like, well, but that headline's already been out there, and it's, that's the story for hours now.
Yeah.
You're not going to see that retracted anywhere, I'm sure. Well, maybe somewhere.
Right. It really, and those kinds of takes, you know, they're rewarded, you know, like they get more clicks, and there is that incentive to just like run with it and think like, oh, well, even if it's wrong, you know, we get a lot of clicks.
Yeah. Even if it is wrong, we got the click. That's all that matters.
Yeah. Right. It's there's a lot of perverse incentives, I think, going on with social media or internet in general. Yeah.
Yeah. We'll blame social media. Is there a social?
Yeah, sure.
What social media do you prefer so we can blame it more?
Oh, God. Well, I hate it all pretty much, but I'm on Twitter mostly. It's definitely the kind of thing where if I wasn't like promoting my stuff or feeling like I had something positive to say, I probably wouldn't be on there, because I do find it, like, I think social media for me is, on like some psychological personal level, I feel like it's been a net negative, you know. There are obviously positives, but I just feel like it tends to bring out the worst in us so often, and I feel like it's got a lot of problems there.
I was thinking about that as you were saying that, like, obviously social media made this conversation happen, and it made bunches of others for both of us happen, right? But there's all these other conversations that we have that aren't necessarily as productive and as positive and as fruitful as this one is. So you take this one good example, and then you look at the five other ones that you have with somebody about who's the best goaltender for the Penguins. And you realize,
or just there's negatives and positives. I mean, it's like for every, and obviously I don't want to say that it's anywhere near all negative. Obviously there's lots of positives, as you say, but I think and I've actually written about this. Like, I spent several weeks researching a piece about what I saw as the negative effects of social media, and how there's inherent effects of how it amplifies animosity, political animosity, and also you know, extreme views. And I was really proud of it. If anybody wants to look at it, it's called How Social Media Divides Us, and it's on the same site, Medium, where I had the video examination, because I really do, you know, I believe that it's underestimated how much these things are kind of affecting us in these negative ways.
And for all those people actually listening on the podcast, links will be in the show notes. You just got to find them and click them, because that's what we do around here. But before I forget, tell me about your podcast. What do you mean, the people who read people, what do you do over there?
Yeah, so that's a so I wanted to tie it in. I tied it into my you know, my Poker Tells behavior work. I wanted to think of something that kind of tied into that, and also, you know, reflected my interest in psychology, because I've always been interested in that. So I decided to do a podcast about focused on how people understand other people's behavior, basically. So for a while I was on kind of a political polarization kick, and you'll see that if you check it out. But I also have interviewed, you know, a range of people, like including, you know, jury consultants and interrogation experts, about, you know, reading, just basically reading people in various ways. I interviewed a bus driver about, like, you know, predicting the behavior of pedestrians or drivers, you know, basically just anything from a wide range of angles of how people use and predict human behavior, basically. Then I got into this whole, like, how social media is polarizing us kick, and delved into, I interviewed quite a few people who were experts in political polarization, you know, like what the U.S. is going through and how that relates to other countries, and how it relates to psychology and things like that. I've been on that kick, but basically it's a psychology behavior podcast.
Yeah. So I'm sitting here thinking, I have a guest for you that you need to talk to, because he fits that line pretty well, but I don't want to mention his name, because obviously if he doesn't come on your show, that'd look pretty foolish of me to mention his name.
Oh, yeah, send it to me. Yeah, please. I'm always looking for interesting ideas, and I have a whole list of things people have sent me that's on my, like, backlog of interesting guests. Yeah, so I'd love to hear it. Yeah.
Yeah, but you'll find this one really interesting. I'll actually send you a show that I did with him, and then you'll see why I'm thinking about you in this this vein. But
listen to that.
Now I just totally forgot what I was going to ask you. Coming out of that, that's good.
Oh, well, you had an interesting guest idea, so maybe it was...
Yeah, that's the important part of that. At least I remember that much. So but take me back. How long have you been doing your show?
It's been probably about 2 years now, and I just kind of put them out. I'm not as scheduled or productive as you. I kind of just put it out every once in a while when I have some time, but I'd love to do it more often. It's basically just kind of a passion project when I get an interesting guest and I'm like, oh, I got to do that.
Insanity works both ways, though. Need I remind you?
What's that?
Insanity works both ways. It can work for you and it can work against you.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Obsession. Yeah. No, a little bit of obsession can be good. It's helped me. It's good to have a little bit.
I see your website. I see it in my head, but I can't remember what it is. Tell people where they can get your website and your books too, while we're at this point.
ReadingPokerThills.com is my main site. Yeah.
So this is an interesting question. This comes from Germantown Runner. Are you surprised at the number of states that are legalizing full blown gambling now?
I can't say I'm surprised. I mean, it's hard for me to understand the various factors that lead to, criminalizing or decriminalizing it. I feel like a big part of it is just states wanting money, so whether it's for whatever other factors are there, I think a lot of it boils down to that. But honestly, I don't know much about all the various factors. I know there's all sorts of political things there and financial things. And
I'm shocked and appalled it comes back to money for the government.
Yeah, who could foresee that?
No, I was down near Pittsburgh the other day, and MGM Grand or somebody, the official betting partner of the Steelers, and I went, boy, I should really get Pete Rose on my show and ask him how he feels about that. Has anybody asked him about that? I don't know. Maybe somebody out there in the universe can help me. Has somebody asked Pete Rose about all this? Because that'd be phenomenal.
That would be, if he could, that sounds like a great grab. So I assume he's still alive. I haven't thought about him in a long time.
Last I checked, maybe we should check that too.
Yeah, don't invite him on if he's deceased.
Well, remember, I told you this show used to be a paranormal show, so it could stop now.
Oh, right. I saw that. I saw that on your site. I didn't realize that until today. I was looking back at your episode or your website. I was like, oh, paranormal stuff. That's cool.
Kind of. It's kind of devolved, involved, upvolved. I don't know. I'm making up words too. Evolved. That might be an actual word, so we might want to go with that one.
Well, that's cool, though. Now you've got me interested. I want to learn more. And if you ever have any interesting videos that you in the past or that you stumble across that you're like, oh, I want to send this to Zach to see what he thinks. I'm always interested. I always encourage people to send me weird videos because I like checking that stuff out.
So I've got to ask you about the most questioned video of all time, then, since we're here. You ready?
I'm afraid to know what it is.
Oh, you've been asked this question before. If not, if you haven't been asked this question before, I'm just going to walk out of here. You're going to have to fill the next 27 minutes.
Is that fair? What is it? Oh, yeah, that's fair.
The moon landing.
Oh, right, yeah. Actually, I was just watching that the other day. I hadn't really examined it, but I happened to have it on and was watching a bit of it. Yeah, I believe that the moon landing was real. Let's just say that. But I have not examined the video.
Well, I mean, there's a lot of people involved in that. One way or the other, right? Mm-hmm. If it was fake, there'd be a whole people that set it up and filmed it and all this other stuff. Mm-hmm. Keeping that secret, plus the people that mm-hmm. were, told to keep the secret of it being real. So we're doubling their people here.
There's a lot of people. Yeah.
I was going to say, either way we cut this, there's a lot of people involved in this mess.
I tend to err on the side of thinking that large conspiracies are very hard to keep, because even with a conspiracy of two people, you can't keep, people just won't shut up. So I tend to operate under the conspiracies are very hard to keep.
Back to the poker thing for a minute. Somebody with pocket aces, it's hard to keep that secret for more than 5 minutes.
Well, of all the tells, there can be some very good tells preflop of somebody having pocket aces. There's very few strong hand tells. You know, it's hard to get strong hand tells, but preflop with pocket aces, you can. There's a good number of tells there for a lot of people.
Probably playing off all the chips is one of them. I'm just going to go out on a limb and say that because they're thinking about going all in instantly.
Yeah, there's a lot of loose behavior, like somebody that was very still and buttoned down preflop. Will, you know, with most hands, with almost all their other hands, but you give them pocket kings or pocket aces, and they get a lot more loose in their mannerisms, you know, when they're raising and looking at you a lot more, and those are kind of behaviors like you don't, you know, if they're like, you know, raising all in or something preflop for all their chips, it's like they wouldn't act in those loose ways with any other hands. Some people, you know, obviously I'm not talking about everybody, but for the people who have those kind of tells, there can be some major imbalances for those hands. Yeah.
So I'm going to shift a little bit here because I want to ask you about this, but there's no smooth transition to this. So, of course, with COVID, we've all been doing more Zoom meetings. I'll say the brand name. I was going to say virtual meetings, but I think Zoom's won this. I think it'll always be Zoom, no matter what it is now. Kind of like Xerox. But now you get all the people on the screen, right? Before, if you were in a room, they'd all be around the table. So, just like in poker, it was much harder to read the room because you're trying to look at everybody. But now, you're looking at everybody because they're all in front of you. This is interesting because, like, during meetings, you could see who's actually engaged and who's now actually just not paying attention anymore. So,
yeah,
go ahead.
And I think I think that's what's so tiring about, you know, the Zoom work meetings. You know, you hear people talk about how tiring. You know, one of the factors is you just always are on display, or at least you think you're. You know, you might be being watched, so you always have to keep up your most like perky, attentive self. You know, and I think that's what's so exhausting about it. You know, and it's much more besides like the lag and the various other factors of it. I think that the fact that you're always, you know, aware of that you could be being watched just kind of wears you out. Whereas, you know, like you said, at a regular in-person meeting, you have moments where, you know, like no one's glancing in your direction. You can kind of relax a little bit.
Worst case, you turn yourself into a cat.
Yeah. The judge. Yeah. I mean, I feel like that is a, you know, or a go, you know, just hiding your face. I feel like people should do that more on these meetings because I feel like I've heard people, you know, getting stressed on these meetings, getting worn out. It's like, well, just I think it's okay to, you know, if you've been doing a lot of meetings, just turn your video off. The audio is fine.
Yeah, I've kind of adapted that. Like, I'll have it on for a little bit so people can see that it's really me because for whatever reason, like the voice doesn't give it away, but whatever. And then turn it off just because.
I like that etiquette.
Yeah, I mean, it gives you the validity to know I'm there and actually or was paying attention to you for a few minutes, but then...
Well, and honestly, like, you know, you might relate to this. Like, if I was doing my podcast, I have to do my podcast audio. Like, I feel like I wouldn't be good at interviewing people in person, and I wouldn't be good at interviewing them with a video chat because it's just too many other... there's too many other things in the bandwidth and, like... I honestly think, like, yeah, I wouldn't be. I feel like I'm a good interviewer, audio online, but I wouldn't be a good interviewer in person because I feel like my mind gets distracted with all this, you know, the stuff that's not important, like the in person, you know, the physical stuff, you know, the physical interactions or the mannerisms and the need to make eye contact and stuff like that. Whereas, like, yeah, I don't know if you can relate to that at all, but
I feel like
it makes it much easier to be a strong interviewer online.
Yeah, because for years I do have a video feed of me going for those four people, and I say hello to each one of them individually right now, who watch the video feed, because I don't look at them. It's a byproduct. Mm-hmm. It just kind of goes because I have the ability to do it. You know, trying to get people to coordinate videos, and then you're kind of trying to make sure you're square because they're square, and you're trying to be that CNN type, so you all look good and all the time.
Right.
Fix some of my hair because it's kind of gross at the moment. right? Because that whole other element. So you're distracted by that and you're distracted by this. And then I've doing this live, so I have a chat room that I try to pay attention to kind of manifest some of that good stuff because people come to listen. And if, you know, there, here's this whole dividing. How much can you because then my eyes are shifting between point A and point B, and it looks like I'm not paying attention and I'm not listening. But of course I'm listening. I'm multitasking, or I'm over here scribbling notes a whole different direction. It looks like I'm a caged animal at points, just fighting myself, because I am just fighting myself. It's ugly. So yeah, I totally appreciate that.
There's just so many factors. Yeah, there's just too many points to pay attention to. And yeah, but yeah, it's definitely an extra skill to be able to keep track of all that stuff too, in addition to the audio. Yeah.
And then I often, you know, you mentioned doing it live in person, and I always joked about doing it as a stage show, right, with just me and that person sitting there. But then here I am again, like, I'd be missing that dynamic of those people chatting away, and where would I, you know, and I'm sitting here with my notepad scribbling too, and that's not a good look. You should be able to remember stuff for 5 minutes.
Right, yeah, I'm glad that the internet has helped us become interviewers. I couldn't do it without the internet.
And it also has allowed us to expand outside of our bubble, right? Because I don't think, if you had asked me 5 years ago, would you be talking to a former poker pro? The answer probably would have been no.
Mm-hmm. No, it is pretty amazing, yeah.
And I'm sure you have some of those similar things where you have an interest in something, and now you get to pursue people, jury consultants and this, that, and the other, which makes your knowledge and your, when you go to write something, hey, now you have a deeper pool. If you need a quote from somebody, you can go say, hey, can you give me a quote about, and now you got it.
Yeah, no, it's definitely an amazing age we live in, because I've talked to so many people that, I wouldn't have been able to talk to before, including, quite well-known people and some impressive people that I was honored to talk to. And just, yeah, it's kind of amazing how easy everyone is to reach these days.
Most everyone.
Some people, yeah, within reason.
Yeah, I was gonna say 90% of the population is an email away. Yeah, the other 10% are 15 emails away. Which is fascinating to me. Because then you get to talk to them, and they're just a normal person, and it doesn't seem to connect with them that they're isolated.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the nice thing is people do love to talk about what they're doing. Like, I've had people on my podcast where I'm like, you have nothing better to do than come on my podcast. But I think understandably, people love to talk about what they're doing, and if they can reach a few more people and they think their stuff's important and they can reach a few more people, then I think a lot of people are down for it. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, especially if they know your niche is what your niche is, and they kind of factor into that could be getting them to a whole nother crowd, which is what I find phenomenal.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So. Yeah, that's true. It's all these niches and various audiences. Like, I have a good number of poker players in my class. It's all these overlapping niches.
So, throughout this all, through the writing, through the podcast, through the poker playing, what's been the one thing overrides that kind of just has been that lesson that you learned through all of it?
Oh, geez. like poker and just life in general? Or?
Yeah.
Well, I do, the thing I always come back to with everything is, is that humans have a drive to be very certain about things. Like, we really want certainty, we strive for it, and uncertainty and ambiguity really make us uncomfortable, I think. And I think that, whether we're talking about poker, where people, have a need to see themselves as strong players, even when they're not, and they lose a lot of money that way, or whether it's just people overreacting to things online, I think it all comes back to people's need for certainty, that desire for certainty. And I think that's, to me, is humanity's biggest failing across the board, because we want certainty so much that we're willing to, just be our worst selves to get that certainty, whether it's, confidence that this, extreme way of viewing the world is right, or whether it's confidence that we can quickly reach a conclusion about something that's very complicated. I think it's the reason we go down so many bad rabbit holes, you know. And I think even for like people doing horrible things too, I think a big part of that is, you know, us wanting to be certain about this, the world that we've built for ourselves, our existential, you know, frame of the world, you know, and if that frame is threatened, you know, it can make us do horrible things, you know. And I think it all comes back to that stuff for me.
So I used to think that the social media platforms were beyond repair and beyond hope for actual civil discourse and, you know, good things, right? And then a strange thing happened, right? Which blows my mind still when I think about it, which is the Bernie memes, right? You know, Bernie sitting everywhere, everywhere, right? Across the board. It did, I mean, political party didn't matter. They had them everywhere, right? And mm-hmm. For one fleeting moment, well, at least probably about a day, I enjoyed the internet again in the way that I haven't in quite a while. And I thought, maybe, right, maybe we could get a bunch of these days and string them together and the internet will be a happy place again. But, of course, it didn't work out that well.
Yeah, I know what you mean. It's like when the internet said its best, you know, it's doing something kind of goofy that we can just enjoy lightly, you know, and then that, yeah, it reminds you of the good old days when things were simpler and you could just laugh at something goofy and not have any require any deep context for it or be afraid of, you know, something bad happening. Yeah.
Yeah, and then you fall down that rabbit hole of trying to find the most asinine place he was, right? Like you know you start looking for them and you go, I'm pretty sure he showed up in every small diner across the country. As everybody continues to use them
everywhere, yeah, right.
So the other, of course, I'm not sure you're in this, but I bet you have a take on it—the Bitcoin and all this cryptocurrency stuff. Because it's going to be interesting.
Oh God!
Oh God!
I don't know.
You don't know?
I just don't. I don't know anything about it. I mean, I feel like that's another area where everybody wants to be certain and have an opinion on that, you know. And it's like I would have to study that topic for like weeks or months before I had felt like I had an educated opinion. But I see so many people like in the poker community and elsewhere where they have formed these confident, you know, viewpoints about Bitcoin and cryptocurrency. And I just, you know, I would need a lot more information. I mean, it's a complex, I think that nobody would, you know, nobody involved in it would deny it's complex, but I don't have much of an opinion.
No, well, that's good though, because you're probably the one person who hasn't much of an opinion on it, which is good, because it seems everybody has their hot take and they have their favorite, and it's just, I don't want to say out of control, but it seems, again, it's so polarized anymore about everything that you either are or not.
Yeah, I can't relate to that stuff. I mean, I read that content on social media about all these strong opinions about all this stuff. And I'm like, where are you getting all this confidence? Like, I don't know.
And does anybody ever admit they're wrong? Just asking hypothetically.
It's a lost art. Actually, that's one of the things I talk about in my social media. There was a very interesting study from like the 1950s, a respected psychology study that it was about, you know, just the act of writing something down made you stick to that thing you've written down more, that belief. And that was even for people that didn't show that belief to anyone else. Like even if they just wrote it down as study, they were more committed to it. And also, but for the people that was made public, where their written statement was made public, it was even more a factor. So, you know, that was one of the things I led with in my piece, was because, and I was apparently the first person to link that to social media. Surprisingly, I was really surprised that I have talked to a good number of social media researchers and political psychologists who had never seen that linked to the study before, the fact that we're constantly in the act of writing things down online. And what is that? How is that having an effect on making us stick to our guns more for all these things that in the past would have been like passing thoughts or passing conversations? And now we're writing it down in email. We're writing it down on social media. People are insulting us about our viewpoints, which makes us stick to our viewpoints more. You know, it's all, I think that's a big factor there too, is in people being more certain these days for things that they really shouldn't be certain about.
That's an interesting thing, because I sit here thinking about the list that I write myself all the time because I need to do X, Y, and Z. And often I never come back to that. Well, I do come back to that list days later. And after I've kind of done two of the three or, you know, things on the list, and it's like, oh, so tear that one up. And then the first few things are the things from the previous list, hopefully, you know, double down and try to get them done. And I never really thought about that, but that's the kind of that same principle. And then I think about, as you're saying that, about how people are posting things all the time online and forcing their beliefs, and it becomes interesting.
I think it's basically like making us more set in our ways, more, you know, set in, we're kind of like building these hardened worldviews around ourselves, you know, with social media. And yeah, and then like the role that insults play, you know, that's a big factor too, is like when you get insulted for something, you're instinctually, you know, psychology studies have shown you're gonna be more likely to stick to your guns once you're insulted about it. Whereas like, you know, the more mature thing to do would be, well, I can change my mind if somebody shows me better information, or I can admit I made a mistake. But I think, you know, as humans, we, you know, I think everybody can relate to that. We have that urge to double down, to defend ourselves, but we have to take that step back to be like, well, wait, why am I defending myself? Can I admit that I was wrong? Can I admit that I phrased it badly, et cetera, et cetera?
I'll never admit that I was the worst history in the host of Medium. That was my first YouTube comment, by the way. And, sorry. Still here.
What was your worst one?
You are the worst history in the host of the host of media anywhere ever.
Whoa, that's a strong one. Did it motivate you?
Apparently, because I'm still here.
Yeah, you're still going. That's the only reason you're still going.
Could be, actually. Because when it came out the other way, I would have been like, oh, I've made it. I'm done. I'm out.
Yeah, you're the best. Well, I quit then.
Yeah. Hey, I've long said that if I ever do a perfect show, you'll never see me or hear from me again.
Yeah, Pete, yeah, well, yeah, why continue? Yeah, it's like,
that's it. That's last it. One. Exactly. Pete, walk off. Walk off. Of course, well, I'm my own worst critic, so I don't know how that works.
Yeah, I hear you on that.
I'm still fascinated by this whole putting every thought and feeling we have out in line, because you just kind of mentioned that, and as it kind of rattles around my head, I find myself today putting a lot less out there, which I'm wondering why that is. Like, as I'm evaluating my perspective based off what you just told me, and I don't think it has anything to do with wanting to be right or wrong, it just seems like I don't feel that what I say or post, or however you want to phrase that, makes a whole bean of difference to anybody.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that is. I mean, I think the more you use social media, there is that feeling of like, am I not adding anything productive because everyone's saying the same thing about these topics? B, am I just adding fuel to the fire in a way that is just, you know, animosity, political polarization, or whatever? And I feel like the more I've thought about social media uses, the less I do it, you know, the less I do it, especially on like hot button topics, because it kind of feels like, well, I'm just, if, what is the point of me posting something that a million other people are posting, you know? And so I think I think the more you think about these topics, it naturally leads, or just the more you know, naturally, as you've, you know, seen in action probably, and you have that feeling of like, well, what am I really accomplishing? I think there is that lessening of using it, you know, or you use it for different purposes. It's like, use it for, you know, you use it differently, basically, yeah. And don't post as much. I definitely don't post as much as I did a few years ago.
So, can I get you on board with my presidential campaign suggestion? Here it is. No campaigning before July 4th. None. We'll move the primaries back and everything. Because with the digital age, everything's around the world anyways. It's not like the old days when they have to send a newspaper reporter out and get the one picture. Yes?
Yeah, well, you know, if you send me a petition, I'd sign that.
I originally said Labor Day, and somebody convinced me that might be a little too close for comfort, but I'll back it up to the 4th of July just to make everybody feel a little bit better, like everybody still has the time. But
then they would just, they'd probably just get around it with all these like shell groups that would be like advertising in other, you know, ways and finding a way around it and stuff.
Well, they're already doing that stuff. That's the thing. Yeah, like, it's like billions and billions of dollars are spent on advertising mm-hmm. for something that, what is it, 85, 90% of people already have made their mind up as soon as the people were decided.
Oh, yeah, actually, on that topic, you might really like a podcast and review I did of a political scientist, Dave Karp, where he talks about basically, you know, in conflict with what many people believe, political advertising, political campaign advertising is pretty useless, and he talks about why, and it's kind of goes against a lot of people's, you know, perceptions of that. That was a really interesting talk. And he talks about the Cambridge Analytica stuff, where a lot of people, in his opinion and many people's, educated people's opinions, that was really overblown because Cambridge Analytica and their opinion basically lied about their ability to sway people, basically, and exaggerated, you know, as many, you know, marketing agencies do, basically.
Not market agents overselling themselves. Oh, stop it.
Yeah, or any company. Yeah, basically almost any company, yeah, overselling themselves, their abilities.
I will say this. I have watched more YouTube in the last month than I did probably in the 4 months leading up to the election. Just saying, because I got tired of all the political ads. Like, every time I watch a video, like, video, it was trying to have a jam session, and next thing I know, did you know that fracking? No, I don't care. Yes, I know I live in Pennsylvania. I know fracking's an issue. Thank you.
Oh, so many commercials.
And then I found myself intentionally searching Google for misleading things just so I could try to get other ads. Like, it was bad. Now my social profile's all out of whack and getting all kinds of weird stuff. But that's okay. So, again, tell people where they could find your website, your podcast, all that fun stuff before we run out of time.
Yeah, if you go to readingpokertells.com, you can find everything there. My Poker Tells stuff, my podcast link. I'm on Twitter at @apokerplayer. That's pretty much it. People Who Read People podcast was the name of the podcast.
Good stuff. Zach, so one more question here, right? So we kind of run the gamut of reading people and all sorts of settings, and talked about film and how, you know, especially how things can be doctored up one way or the other, right? From misleading to having actors. What's the one thing that we need to watch more closely when we're looking at social media posts and trying to decipher, especially if we're trying to decipher, is this a real post or is this somebody just seeking attention or all that fun stuff?
Well, that's a broad one. Are you talking about videos or just posts in general?
Well, videos, because I think that's pretty fun.
Actually, it's funny you say that, because when I posted about that video analysis, somebody pointed out a really good, somebody responded with a really good quote from Bob Saget, which was, you know, he used to host America's Funniest Home Videos, and somebody asked him, you know, and they would get a lot of fake stage videos that they wouldn't want to put on for obvious reasons. And somebody asked him, like, what are the signs of, you know, a fake, a stage video? And he said, the camera is always in the perfect spot, which I thought was a good encapsulation of stage videos in general, because just naming a couple I've seen recently, including the one I analyzed, you can tell a lot about how they stage the shot, you know, like somebody trying to stage something wants you to see what they want you to see, and they will stage things in very clear ways. Whereas like real video, unstaged video, there's a lot of, usually some ambiguity, something happens off screen, something's not clear. Whereas like, you know, for example, this one I saw on Instagram the other day was a cop choking on his gum on the ground, and somebody, you know, getting the handcuff keys from him and then like giving the Heimlich maneuver to the cop to save his life. And I was like, this is so phony. At one point the cop, you know, coughs up his gum right on the hood of the car, you know, so you can tell a lot about how they want you to see everything, how they have the camera in the perfect spot to see everything, because they want you to see everything. Whereas, you know, real videos are seldom that clear. There's a lot of context missing or ambiguity.
Zach, great point. I have to cut you short, but hang out with me for a minute as the outro music plays.
Okay.
And I'll talk.
Thanks a lot, Jim.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The Mount Report. Stay tuned for details on saving money at the Duck Pond Shop. I hope you enjoyed this report. Please subscribe so that you can join us again. And if you appreciate the show, leave us some stars or a review. For more notes from this show or other great shows, check out Mallard.com. A reminder, the views and opinions of this show are those of the host and guests and do not represent any sponsors, affiliates, or any other partners of the Mallard Report. Now for your money-saving tip. Promo code Mallard at checkout of DuckPondShop.com, where you can get your t-shirt, coffee mug, and other great products. That's promo code Mallard at checkout of DuckPondShop.com. Until next week, stay safe and keep quacking.
In a world infatuated with comic fandom, comes a show to help us remember the talents that have inspired us.
Whoa, 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 Kat.
Oh, come on. It wasn't that bad.
It's a bit dramatic. Let's just tell them about the show, guys.
We are the Canned Air Podcast.
Join us weekly for a comedic trip through pop culture.
We also welcome some cool comic creators, as well as some of the voice and screen actors that helped shape your childhood.
Find us on CannedAirPodcast.com and on the Evergreen Podcast Network.